From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Sally Bingham says, in a dynasty, maintaining power is more important than the truth. She says she was tired of being a silenced woman. Bingham's decision to sell her shares in her family's newspapers led to the sale of the Bingham businesses and virtually severed her connection to the family. On today's Fresh Air, Sally Bingham tells her side of the story. Also today, radio for kids that adults like too, with Kathy O'Connell. And we have reviews of a new reissue of Laverne Baker singing the songs of Bessie Smith, and of the return of Peter Falk to TV as the rumpled detective Columbo. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Chances are you're already somewhat familiar with the story of the Bingham family of Louisville, Kentucky. The Binghams own two newspapers, the Louisville Courier-Journal and the Louisville Times, as well as TV and radio stations. But family power struggles led to the sale of all the companies. The story has been interpreted as a family tragedy and the end of an era, as the papers passed from family ownership to the Gannett newspaper chain. Two recent books have told the Bingham family saga and investigated rumors that Robert Worth Bingham, who first bought the paper 70 years ago, inherited his wife's fortune after causing her death. A third book has just been written by Sally Bingham, the granddaughter of Robert Worth Bingham. Sally's decision to sell her 15% share of the stock led to the sale of all the family companies in 1986. She is now the family outcast. In her new memoir, Passion and Prejudice, Sally Bingham tells her side of the story and blames her family's sexist power structure for her role in the dynasty's breakup. I asked Sally Bingham if in a family of great wealth and power, the worst thing you can do is take family problems to the public because it plays into voyeuristic impulses and makes the personal problems more difficult to solve.
Well, in my case, it was a little bit different, Terry, because all the so-called family problems had already been aired, as you know. But what I did show and also attempt to explain is the system in a family that's enormously rich and powerful, and the way that system affects individual lives.
You wanted to sell off your share of the stock in the family newspapers. And by finally selling, you gained money, therefore gained autonomy. What else did you gain and what else did you lose when you sold your stock and when finally the whole paper, the whole company was sold?
That's a very interesting question and a complicated one. When I sold my 15%, my minority share in these three large companies, the price tag on that 15% was about $62 million. Half of that is tied up in trusts, and a considerable amount also went to taxes, lawyers, and so forth. Of the remaining amount, I endowed a foundation for women artists who are feminists in Kentucky. It's called the National Foundation for Women, and I publish a quarterly called The American Voice that's primarily writing by women. We pay our contributors, by the way. And I also was able to buy a house in the country that's available for women's groups. That's all, for me, very positive and very exciting. And I could never have done it without the sale of my 15%. In fact, it's rather difficult for me to think of any losses if we're talking purely in terms of money. I haven't changed my lifestyle particularly. My husband and I did buy a farm out in the country where we live. But I had no real wish to change my lifestyle. I'm not the kind of person that wants to ride around in limousines or wear expensive jewelry. So for me, the money was primarily a means to get money back into the hands of women in Kentucky.
But in talking about what you gained and what you lost, it seems to me what you lost isn't financial as much as it's emotional, if indeed you felt that you suffered any losses through the sale.
It's hard to say that I lost a great deal because, assuming that you mean the Bingham family, the relationships were so precarious long before the sale, and the fact that I left home at 17 and didn't come back for almost 20 years meant that really they were no longer my sole emotional support. It was sad to see that the differences that had always been there were so profound that there was no way to resolve the differences, but it was not as though I was still a 15-year-old girl living at home and suddenly the whole family turned on me. I knew from very early that they would never understand what I was intended to do with my life. And when you know that, you find ways to separate yourself and you find another system of support, my own family, my husband, my sons, and my close friends. And that is the way to survive. So it wasn't a loss of the kind that I think people imagine when they think of a normal family, a close family, and then suddenly everyone is angry at each other. That was not the situation.
One of the most controversial episodes in the story of the Bingham family was your decision to sell your share of stocks in the family company. You and your sister-in-law, and your mother had seats on the board of directors. And your brother had said that he didn't think he could continue to be the CEO of the company to manage the papers unless the women on the board resigned. And that eventually led to your decision to sell. Were the women the only family members on the board at the time, or were there men family members on the board as well?
There was only my father and my brother. They were the only Bingham men left. You know, I had two brothers who had died. Mm-hmm. They remained, of course, on the boards.
Now, your brother said that he didn't think he could continue to operate the paper unless the women family members were replaced by professionals who would have a kind of professional instead of a family relationship to the company. Did that make any sense to you? And I ask this in the context of knowing how difficult it can be for family members who have this emotional history to deal with professional problems and professional crises in a business.
Well, first of all, the idea of introducing professionals came much later. The first idea was simply to get rid of all the women on the boards. Then I think as they realized that this was going to look pretty bad, even in a community like Louisville, they began to talk about bringing in so-called professionals. My response to that was great. It would be wonderful, particularly since they were considering having two women and one African-American, which would have been wonderful on those boards. But I didn't see why those people needed to replace me or the other women. It seemed to me that since we all depended for our livelihood on these companies, we had a reason to exercise our responsibilities as shareholders just the way all other shareholders do, that is to come to meetings and know something about the business as it is being conducted. There was no reason why they couldn't have expanded these boards to include newcomers, people from outside the state, so-called professionals. I think it would have been a great addition. But that was a separate issue from throwing all the Bingham women off the boards.
What was behind your decision to sell?
Simply being thrown off the boards.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had asked for $42 million, and you basically gave your family the chance to buy the stock.
Yes, they turned me down, and I then came down to $32 million, mm-hmm. and they came back with an offer of 26.5, which, as it turned out, was about half, less than half, what the stock was worth. I didn't feel that as a self-respecting woman, and also in terms of my children, I could accept a 50% devaluation of my holdings.
Now, you know, it's both a professional thing and a family thing at the same time. The argument could be made that you could have lost a lot of money but still came out of it very, very wealthy. The family would have been able to keep the newspaper and the family would have at least had the image of being more intact.
I'm not a great believer in images.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that would mean that I would have to have a lifelong devotion to the notion that a family-owned newspaper is more important than justice. Because to me it would be unjust to myself to accept 50% of what these stock were worth. And Terry, I do think it's just worth speculating whether if a man were in this position, that question would even be raised.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Sally Bingham, and she's written a family memoir called Passion and Prejudice. You say in your book that what you wanted to do was weigh your loyalty to the family and its myths against your autonomy. What were the myths of the family that you're describing there?
Well, they're the very familiar myth of male dominance, that a family and also the country or the state that it's in is basically a pyramid. At the top of the pyramid, you have one man. Below him, you have several other men who are either actually his sons and grandsons or people from the same class whom he has groomed to take over. And then at very further down the pyramid, you have a lot of women, a lot of working-class men, and all African-Americans. So that is the family structure in patriarchy, and of course it reflects the structure of the United States today to a great extent. That does not permit autonomy, except perhaps at the top, and I sometimes think the men at the top are just as harassed by the system as the people further down. In order to have autonomy, a woman who is involved in a situation like that must either rise to the top, if that's possible, or get out. Otherwise, we'll be crushed.
Mm-hmm. Your memoir is really a feminist analysis.
Yes.
Of life within your family and a feminist analysis of your decision to sell your share.
Yes.
Of the stock. And I think some people wonder if you are perhaps using feminism as justification for actions that would otherwise be considered self-serving.
I can't tell you how much people love to hear you say that. It's been used very widely to try to discredit me. And other myths that are used is that I'm about to get a divorce, I may end up in a madhouse, and so on. All very hard to deal with. However, on the issue of feminism, I should first define it as my belief in equality and my belief in the development of the feminine, if you can use that word, consciousness. It goes back for me to my childhood. I would not have known what to call it, but from an early age, I noticed that women who were comfortable, privileged women seemed to have unhappy, empty lives. That was not something that was acknowledged publicly. It was something that I noticed. Then when I was in college and was writing and published my first novel in 1960 called After Such Knowledge, Houghton Mifflin, it was a novel dealing with the issue of illegal abortion, as of course it was illegal at the time, and what this did to the life of a woman who became pregnant and had to get married because of it. I feel as though my feminist credentials are impeccable. And more than that, I put my money where my mouth is.
Do you think that a lot of people become impatient with women who are wealthy and talk about problems that they face within the family? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, and I think they're absolutely right, except what they should become impatient with is a system that allows this grotesque accumulation of wealth at the top. Most women who are called wealthy are not themselves wealthy. Their husbands or their fathers are. Their money, which they have inherited, is largely tied up in trusts controlled by men. So I think, again, women are standing in for criticism of the system. What we have to begin to wonder is why wealth is accumulated from generation to generation in these enormously rich families. There's a statistic that something like 1% of the population in the U.S. now controls 40% of the assets. That is grotesque. But attacking individual women is going to have no effect on the system. In fact, it simply disguises the problem.
Well, you're referring to the lack of autonomy that you think many wealthy women have. You say that in your family, the arrival of checks, inherited money, depended on your parents' secret assessment of your maturity. And you describe a perverse connection between love and money.
Yes, it is perverse. If money can never be discussed, there's no logical way to deal with it. It becomes a mystery. And therefore, when you're given money, you don't know really why. You don't know if that's because suddenly money has become available or because you've acted right or said the right things. It's a very effective way to control children because it means you're always off balance. You don't know really whether you deserve money, whether you can earn money, or what you have to do to earn money. It's part of the mystery that is a way of controlling women.
If you think that the children in your family were controlled by the way money was allotted, do you think that the brothers and sisters were controlled in a different way through money?
That's interesting. I can't really answer that because it's so many years ago that I don't remember exactly how it was handled. But I think whenever young men are groomed to go into a business, they know that the money is going to be available to them, and both in the form of large salaries as well as possessing the majority of the shares. So it's not a question of sort of cash handouts. It's a question of expectations.
You're in the somewhat paradoxical position of questioning inherited wealth, yet having inherited a good deal of it, and through shares that you inherited, having become very wealthy yourself. How are you going to deal with your children and grandchildren in terms of passing on money so that you try to avoid some of the mistakes you think your family made?
We try to talk about it a lot. That's the first issue. My sons have inherited an enormous amount of money from my father, which I regret. He bypassed me in his will and gave the money to my three sons. I regret it not because I needed the money, I don't, but because I think for young people to come into that kind of wealth at the age of 21 is very complicated. However, all my sons feel, as I do, something we've talked about a great deal, that money is a wonderful gift. It's not right that any of us should have these huge amounts, but that was not within our control. That happened because of other people's decisions. So the aim is to find a way to use it, to deal with some of the hideous problems that we're facing in the U.S. today, to use it to endeavor not only to help, but to understand what other people need.
My guest is Sally Bingham, and she's written a new family memoir called Passion and Prejudice. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sally Bingham. Her family owned the fortune that controlled the Louisville Courier and the Louisville Times. 2 years ago, Sally Bingham sold her shares of the family company, and family disagreements forced the sale of those papers. Her book, Passion and Prejudice, is her version of those events. You were talking about ways that you'd like to use the money for social change.
Yes.
I'm wondering about ways you've decided to use it personally. One thing that you really discuss a lot in the book is what it's like to grow up in a family where there are a lot of servants and how you can come to feel very close to some of the servants who've raised you.
Yes.
And you even point out how at your brother's funeral, the servants were at home cleaning, et cetera, and weren't invited to come mourn with the family at the
funeral.
They did
mourn, but
their closeness.
They did mourn, but they mourned in private. It was not with the white people.
Do you have servants?
I have a wonderful team of three women who come in once a week and clean the house. I don't know what I would do without them. One thing that makes that form of help so much more palatable is that these women are well paid. They are not in the position that black women were in when I was a child, who could really command very little in terms of either pay, health benefits, insurance of any kind. This is a business. It's a house cleaning business. And I think that makes a great deal of difference in terms of the lack of dominance in my position. It's something I always have to work at, because I think whenever we hire people to do work we don't want to do, we're faced with the question of whether we consider that they are inferior. It's interesting to remember what Lillian Smith wrote about this in a marvelous book of essays called Killers of the Dream, about the fact that Southerners who have been raised in earlier generations by black servants whom they loved profoundly later had to renounce that love because the society taught them that these people were inferior. That's a problem I've been aware of all my life and have struggled, I hope, fairly successfully against.
Now that you are trying to use some of your money for feminist causes and for other social change, you're probably traveling in a somewhat different circle than you used to
Thank
be.
Thank God.
Well, it's a circle I imagine might be just a little bit suspicious of vast wealth. And I would guess you've really had to prove how serious you are about your convictions.
They should be suspicious. They have every reason to be suspicious. Philanthropy is sometimes used as a way to silence people, to placate them, to buy friendship. There's every reason to be suspicious. I have no particular difficulty with it because of the way I live my life, because of what I write about, and because of the way I give my money. I don't give my money to mainstream social and political activities. And that there is no other way of convincing people. You have to do as you say. And fortunately, I find most people, particularly in the groups I'm interested in, are able to be fairly open-minded.
This may seem like an odd question, but have you ever envied people who aren't wealthy in that their politics wouldn't be questioned in the ways that yours might?
No, not at all. Money is a wonderful opportunity. I would never regret having money, and I think it's absolutely appropriate that people should question me. I would be, in fact, I think it would be rather alarming if they didn't, because it would mean they had simply accepted the notion that certain people in this society, primarily white men, are enormously wealthy, without connecting that to the fact of what has gone disastrously wrong with other people in the society. So the questions, if they come from genuine curiosity, are quite welcome. What is hard to deal with is a pernicious stereotype, which people sometimes accept, of a wealthy, grasping woman, which of course has nothing to do with me.
Sally Bingham is my guest, and she's written a family memoir called Passion and Prejudice. You write in your book that the system promotes nepotism yet degrades those who profit by it.
Yes.
And I want to ask you about a kind of controversial situation you were in. A friend of yours who was the editor of the book section at one of the papers your family owned was taking a two-month leave because she required surgery. You say that she asked you if you'd be interested in filling in for her during the interim. And you did. And after she came back from her operation, your parents suggested that you keep the job.
That's right. Well, not immediately after. She'd been back, I think, for about a month when they raised that issue with me. I think that's the closest point at which the Bingham myth nearly took me in. It was a wonderful job.
Let's explain what happened. You say that after your parents suggested you take the job, that you initially turned them down and said that you were uncomfortable about it, that you suggested that they keep the other editor in there
yes.
for another 6 months, and if it still didn't work out, then you would take the job.
Exactly.
And in fact, that's what happened, although the book editor has never spoken to you since and thinks that you really cheated her out of a job.
I also insisted that she be given another job, so she was a features writer and remains a features writer at the newspaper to this day.
Well, this is a very awkward, to say the least, position to be in. I don't really know what the circumstances were. I know how you describe it in your book. But did you ever think that perhaps you shouldn't take the position?
Of course.
Just because of the way it would look, even if you were absolutely justified
of
in
course.
Accepting it?
Of course. I realized this was likely to be widely misinterpreted. I was also extremely concerned for Shirley Williams. She was someone I liked, and I wanted to be certain that she had a job that she felt was the equivalent of the book page job, which was what she was given. But I did have a concern for the fact that the book page was important in Kentucky. It was basically the only source of book news in that state, and I felt I could do a better job, and I did do a better job. There's something to be said for that, after all.
Did you ever want to get a similar position at another paper so that there wouldn't be the problem of nepotism and you could still do the kind of work you wanted to do?
If I had been willing to move, that certainly would have been an option. At that point, I was really not willing to move.
Mm-hmm. Have you had to deal with the question of nepotism yourself? For instance, I read somewhere, and I'm not certain if this is true, so correct me if I'm misstating this, but I read somewhere that at one point your husband had been appointed by you to head the Kentucky Foundation for Women.
That's one of Marie Brenner's lies, and you need to find out from her where she got that.
Okay, she's the author of a book about
yes, that's where that turned up. She picked that up from gossip in Louisville. Southern cities tend to believe that men run everything. They're right. Men do run 99% of everything. However, I'm the founder and director of the Kentucky Foundation for Women.
And your husband was never...
He's the treasurer.
Oh, I see, okay. Well, how do you feel about that, about having someone in your family, having seen how dangerous it can be when people in the same family...
It's full of ambiguities. Uh-huh. I think the reason we did it was that we are so beleaguered in Louisville that we really need each other. I think ideally a foundation should not have family members in it. I don't think a business should have family members in it, simply because families are complicated and difficult enough. But with the foundation, as I say, we were very beleaguered setting it up, still are, and we need each other's help and support. That doesn't mean that, 20 years down the road, that's the way the foundation will be run. The foundation's endowed to outlast me, so I imagine there'll be many, many women who will be running it after my time.
Are you on speaking terms with your family?
I can't speak to people who send 11.5 pounds of documents through the mail to every newspaper and magazine in this country. There's no way to speak to people who act in that way and even send these terrible letters to my sons.
You're referring to refutations that your family sent to book editors around the country in terms of your book, refuting what was in your book.
Right. Those people, to my mind, I can't speak to. They're too destructive. They have too much power and money, and they have a newspaper and a law firm that they use against me. We're moving beyond what people normally conceive of as family conversations.
One last thing. We were talking a little bit about what it's like to be in a kind of family dynasty that's being talked about a lot in the press. What's the experience like for you now of being a woman with a book out whose story is very controversial? And so you're being written about and talked about, sometimes in flattering, sometimes in less than flattering ways.
Well, I find it very exciting because nearly all the reporters I meet make an attempt to understand what I'm saying. They may not agree with me, but they are open-minded enough and honest enough to hear what I have to say. What has been very defeating and discouraging in Kentucky is that there is no one left among the professional news people who is willing to hear what I have to say. That has made my life extremely difficult and made my children's lives extremely difficult. But getting out into what I call the big world is an enormous relief because there are people who know what I'm talking about. There are people who understand the changes in this society in the last 20 years and how they have affected women. And they understand how this story fits into that whole paradigm.
What does the word dynasty mean to you now?
An emptiness. I don't think there is such a thing. We can't pass it on. I quote in the front of my book a quotation from Thomas Paine that says, one generation has no rights in the next generation. Dynasty is simply an attempt to freeze the society so that there's no real free flow of ideas and money.
But again, you're going to try to pass on your money to your family.
I have no choice. My father made that decision.
You mean in trusts that were set up?
Yeah. When he died, he left my sons this money in his will.
But you have your own money from the sale of your shares.
Sure, but that's not a dynasty. A dynasty is when you attempt to pass it on to your kith and kin. I have no intention of doing that.
You have no intention of passing on your own money?
No. First of all, my children are enormously wealthy. There would be absolutely no point in me burdening them with more money. Second of all, the money can be better used for other purposes.
So you'll have a will passing your money on to people or to organizations outside of your family?
Well, it'll be my foundation, yes.
All of your money will go to your foundation?
Yes. That's what I believe in. And as I say, my children will be enormously wealthy, so it's very important not to misunderstand that. It would be ludicrous for me to then add on to their already enormous fortunes with yet even more money. Remember, we live in one of the poorest states in the country. It's very important for money to get out of private hands and get into the sections where it's so badly needed. We have the highest adult illiteracy rate in the country, for example, highest teenage pregnancy rate. All these things have to be addressed to some degree with private money. As we know, there's very little federal money, there's very little state money for these purposes. And the idea that instead somehow it ought to go to just to prolong a name, prolong an enormous accumulation of wealth. To me, there's something obscene in that.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Terry.
My guest has been Sally Bingham, and her new memoir is titled Passion and Prejudice, and it's just been published by Knopf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with economist Hernando de Soto, and he puts forth the argument that capitalism has never really been given a chance in the Third World. And he does this by tracing the growth of the black market in Lima, Peru. And he thinks that the black market is a great example of prospering capitalism, except that it's underground. His new book is called The Other Path, The Invisible Revolution in the Third World. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Once upon a time, Kathy O'Connell hosted a national radio show called Kids America. When that show closed shop, O'Connell packed up and moved to Philadelphia, where her new show, Kids Corner, still uses the radio to entertain and educate children. Coming up, we meet Kathy O'Connell. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a reissue of rhythm and blues singer Laverne Baker performing songs associated with Bessie Smith. Peter Falk is back in his rumpled trench coat, and Columbo is back on TV. Television critic David Bianculli has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. President Bush today announced a four-point program to help rescue the nation's savings and loan industry. The bailout would be financed in part by $50 billion in government bonds. Bush ruled out the possibility of a fee by depositors to help pay for the plan. The president blamed part of the crisis on what he called unconscionable risk-taking, fraud, and outright criminality. He said he has authorized spending an additional $50 million to track down and prosecute SNL officers suspected of wrongdoing. The plan would overhaul the regulatory system and place the agency that insures thrift deposits under the supervision of the Treasury Department. The controversial pay raise for Congress and high-ranking judiciary officials is probably dead. Today, House Speaker Jim Wright decided that the House will take a vote on the proposed 50% increase before it's scheduled to go into effect at midnight tomorrow. NPR's Cokie Roberts reports.
If Congress is forced to vote on salary increases, it almost always says no. The public outcry against legislators giving themselves pay hikes is simply too loud for members to feel they can politically resist it. So the strategy this time around was simply to avoid a vote and let the pay raise automatically take effect. The leaders of both houses of Congress and both political parties had signed on to the plan, along with both the Reagan and Bush administrations, but the voters did not. And after the Senate decided 95-5 to reject the pay raise, the heat was on the House. Today, Republican leaders told their Democratic counterparts that any procedural vote could be seen as an attempt to preserve the pay raise. And when it came time to adjourn, the House members refused. So Speaker Jim Wright has now scheduled an open vote on the pay raise tomorrow, and the members are virtually certain to say no to the increase. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
The chief ethics advisor to President Bush has decided to step down as chairman of a family-owned communications company and put his personal assets in a blind trust. C. Boyden Gray earlier had said he would remain at his post at the multimillion-dollar firm, saying he did not consider it a conflict of interest. Gray's decision to resign follows recent publicity of his financial affairs and consultations with the leaders of Bush's new ethics commission. Solidarity leader Lech Wałęsa today called on Poland's communist authorities to give up their monopoly on power and to grant citizens the freedom they need. His comments were broadcast nationwide on state-run television as part of a report on historic negotiations between the government and the opposition. Jane Dobia has more from Warsaw.
Wałęsa said that the current crisis in Poland is the result of an evil system where people still feel Joseph Stalin at their backs. He demanded the re-legalization of Solidarity, as well as independent unions among students and farmers. But negotiators' agenda went far beyond the union's legal status. For example, Wałęsa also insisted there must be greater democracy in Poland's legal system and freedom of the press. On the government side, Minister of the Interior Czesław Kiszczak proposed non-confrontational elections to the parliament and the creation of three branches in the government, legislative, judicial, and executive. It's not clear where all the proposals that were offered at the negotiations will lead, but Solidarity advisor Bronisław Geremek warned that both sides must recognize how big a chance the talks represent and how dearly they will pay if that chance is wasted. For National Public Radio, I'm Jane Dobia in Warsaw.
Soviet officials in Afghanistan say some 1,000 Red Army troops will remain at Kabul airport until the end of the week, despite communist newspaper reports that all troops have now left the city. All Soviet troops are to be out of Afghanistan by February 15th under a UN-negotiated settlement. In Pakistan today, Soviet Foreign Minister Ervin Shevardnadze met with Pakistani Prime Minister Bhutto. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. Laverne Baker, like many rhythm and blues singers of the 1950s, had many of her best records copied by pop artists who then made them into hits. Songs like Tweedledee and Tra-La-La. In 1958, Baker cut an album of songs borrowed from the great blues singer Bessie Smith. But Smith had been dead for 20 years. So jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Baker wasn't ripping her off, and the album is a winner.
Let me tell you, girls, if your man ain't treating you right, come on and preach them blues, sing them blues. They certainly sound good to me.
You know the expression, high concept? That's what Hollywood types call a project you can sum up in a sentence. You know, like three bachelors inherit a baby. The term is a classic misnomer. Most high concepts are pretty low. But there are exceptions, like the 1958 album Laverne Baker Sings Bessie Smith, just reissued by Atlantic. On it, Baker remakes songs associated with the greatest blues singer of the 1920s. It sounds shaky, but it works great, because Laverne Baker has a powerful, raspy voice not unlike Bessie Smith's, and because the arrangements capture the spirit of the originals. Baker's blues are more streamlined, but they rely on call and response between voice and instrument, just like Bessie Smith's records. The trombonist who answers Laverne Baker on Empty Bed Blues is Jimmy Cleveland, who sneaks in some sly references to blues in the night.
I woke up this morning with an awful aching head.
Like Bessie Smith's recordings, Laverne Baker's revivals are often triumphs of style over a lack of substance. Many of the songs Smith recorded had little to do with authentic blues. Like Bessie Smith, Laverne Baker plumbs emotional depths unrelated to a song's trite lyric. Baker's 1958 session may have been the last time anyone put over a credible version of this next relic. Teddy Roosevelt's Rough Riders supposedly sang it while charging San Juan Hill in 1898.
Come along, get ready, wear your brand brand new gown, 'cause there's gonna be a meeting in this good, good old town, where you know everybody and they all know you, and you got a jazz band just to drive away your blues. When you hear that music start to play, tap your feet, start to step and sway. When you get that rhythm, you're gonna
that's Buck Clayton on trumpet. Bessie Smith had recorded with jazz greats like Louis Armstrong, Jack Teagarden, and James P. Johnson. Laverne Baker's band includes distinguished Count Basie vets like Buck Clayton and trombonist Vic Dickinson. The arrangements are by Ernie Wilkins and Nat Pierce, both of whom wrote for Basie, and by Phil Moore. The success of Laverne Baker Sings Bessie Smith reminds us how closely allied jazz, blues, and American pop used to be, back when a radio star like Baker could tackle such material and not make a fool of herself. More recent projects in the same vein, Diana Ross butchering Billie Holiday or Linda Ronstadt gushing standards, are sad evidence that those days are long gone.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Laverne Baker Sings Bessie Smith on the Atlantic label. This is Fresh Air. Talk show for kids. That's how Kathy O'Connell describes Kids Corner, her nightly hour-long public radio show. The program is produced in Philadelphia at NPR member station WXPN. But public radio listeners may also remember O'Connell as the co-host of the nationally distributed show Kids America. Like Kids America, Kids Corner is a mix of games, records, and information, as regular contributors and Kathy O'Connell talk with kids in the studio and on the phone. This is how Kathy opened her show 2 days before George Bush became president.
Now, we're taking your advice right now at 898-8868 or 1-800-KIDS-XPN. Advice for the new president. What should he do? He's taking office on Friday. How should he spend the next 4 or maybe the next 8 years? Joining me in the studio will be Lois Hagerty, who is a state representative from the 148th Legislative District. Talk to both of us at 898-8868 or 1-800-KIDS-XPN. Tonight's music challenge is between Bobby McFerrin and Los Lobos, and I have a special guest in the studio with me right now. Emma's here. Hi.
Hi.
Emma's here because her mom is answering telephones here at the Kids' Corner. So what's your research question, Emma?
When Theodore Roosevelt was elected vice president, who was elected president with him?
What number should kids call when they know the answer to your question?
898-88.
When I was a kid, every weekday I'd sit home and I'd watch the Mickey Mouse Club and spend a lot of time envying all the kids who were on the Mickey Mouse Club. What I like about Kids America is that everybody gets to be on it. All you have to do is like pick up the phone and you're on the show. You don't have to envy the kids who are on it.
Oh yeah. Well, that is the beauty of Kids Corner, you know, which grew out of Kids America, is that it's accessible. It's right at your fingertips. The kids can pick up the phone and call. And I was like that about the Mickey Mouse Club, too. One of the things I could never understand was why Annette got all the attention while Darlene was the really talented one. And it was because you could see Annette, and Annette was so pretty. And I think one of the beauties of radio is the anonymity. You can be sitting there with your finger up your nose, or you can be real shy, and nobody's looking at you. Nobody's really studying you. You have a freedom to be free.
It's something I've always enjoyed about being on the radio, too, the act of being invisible.
Oh, yeah.
Not being judged on how you look. A lot of people say there's no radio for kids. And to that, I'd kind of disagree in the sense that I think top 40 radio mm-hmm. serves a function really well. It certainly did for me when I was growing up. But I think you work off of that. You incorporate a lot of rock and roll onto the show and play a lot of hits. And you also play world beat music and oldies and novelty records.
My favorites. Those are my favorites. The novelty records especially. The ones that I listened to when I was a kid. Tom Lehrer, Alan Sherman, Stan Freberg. They all do things that are still valid today. But the fact is, the kids are used to listening to rock and roll radio. And they're used to that power of being able to turn the dial. It's not the story time that was big 40 years ago, because you can't get kids to listen for a half hour or an hour to a story, no matter how beautifully it's produced. Kids want to hear other kids' voices. They want to hear rock and roll music. And I hope they want to hear Stan Freberg, because they're going to on my show.
When I was a kid, I know I really hated being patronized by adults. And I hated a kind of sunshiny personality where no matter what you were feeling, mm-hmm. no matter how miserable you were, everything's going to be okay.
Yeah.
Did you dislike that when you were a kid? And are you aware of trying to not become that on the air yourself?
When I was a kid, my idol, and to this day, as far as children's programming is concerned, was Soupy Sales.
Oh, yes, I remember
Soupy
him.
Sales knew exactly what to say to kids and to make it funny for adults as well. And the fact is, kids see an awful lot. You know, most parents talk to kids as though they're regular, normal people. So when you see someone come along and talk to a kid like this, kids start cringing. And I think you got to keep it funny. You got to keep it hip, because kids want to be cool. That's the most important thing for a kid, is to be cool.
Have you ever had a kid call up on the air and start to cry?
Yes. We've had, especially around the time that of the Challenger, because kids saw that. Kids saw the tragedy right there, and they did not know how to handle it. Adults didn't know how to handle that. And television, which has been part of their lives since birth now, kind of betrayed them. I've also had a child call and announce on the air that his father had just died. And this is in the middle of a phone call, in the middle of a call where he was answering a question. He said, oh, by the way, I just wanted to tell you that my father died this weekend.
What did you do?
I said that I was very sorry, that we were all very sorry. And I said, I'm going to put you on hold for just a moment. We're going to go to a song because I want to talk to you off the air. Because it wasn't a time to be on the air. And I think the kids sensed that, the other children who were listening, because we got a lot of calls from other children just saying they were sorry.
You started doing a kid show in New York.
Yes.
On NPR station WNYC.
Yes.
First it was a local show, then it went national.
Mm-hmm.
Kids America became a national show, and then it was on but over 20,
About 26 markets.
Right, on public radio stations. Then it lost its funding, and it very suddenly went off the air.
Yeah, very suddenly.
And just about 4 days later, you showed up in Philadelphia at a station called WXPN, hosting the show on a local level.
Yeah.
I heard you that first day that you were on, and I have no idea what you were feeling, but I really wondered what you were feeling, and I was wondering what it felt like to have a national show that was now a local show, to be in a strange city, doing the show with less resources because mm-hmm. it was a smaller station and it was a local program, and knowing that you had to kind of build from scratch and start all over again.
Thank goodness it's live, because I've got to concentrate on the moment. I've got to concentrate on making the moment as good as possible. And then afterwards, I can throw up, because at the time surrounding that first show, I was scared to death. I have to, primarily because it was a new city and it was all on my shoulders. We went from a staff of 9 people where I was treated like a queen, I gotta tell you, I had it really good there, to a smaller station where, again, I'm treated very well, but it's all me.
You know, a lot of people look nostalgically back at their own childhood and think like, oh, childhood, what a carefree time that was. How do you feel emotionally when you look back at your childhood?
Awful.
Why?
Awful. Childhood is a terrible time. It's not carefree at all. In, for my personal case, I was a fat kid. And it's terrible being the fat kid in the class. It doesn't matter if you're the smart kid or the talented kid. If you're the fat kid, it's not great. And the same is true if you're the kid with glasses or if you're the kid with buck teeth or if you're the stupid kid in the class. Everybody's got something different about them. And when you're a kid, it's magnified 10,000% in your mind. And also, kids are powerless. Kids and old people are the most powerless people in this country. And at least old people, you know, have age on their side. But childhood is not all it's cracked up to be.
Do you think about this a lot when you talk with kids on your show?
Yeah. I think, don't worry, you'll get through it. You grow out of this. Enjoy it while you can and enjoy what you can from it. But you do grow out of it.
Professionally, you work with children all the time now, long distance via the radio. Are there kids in your life personally?
Yes, I have an adoptive family. My own immediate family is all dead, but I have a wonderful adopted family in California. And in fact, my 10-year-old niece, who is like Kathy Jr., she's a musician and she writes rock and roll songs. She's coming to stay with me for the summer. So that's how I keep in touch with things. And I borrow other people's kids.
Are you one of the people who's so busy working with children professionally that you don't know if you have time to have any as a mother?
I've thought about that, and I'm not sure. I'm not sure. Maybe it's because I'm so busy working with them that maybe someplace in me there's something saying, no, I have enough to do with children already. Maybe I don't want to bring any more. I'm not sure. I'm really not, but tick, 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 tick. You know, biological clock starts ticking away. You start thinking about that more and more.
I want to thank you a lot for telling us about yourself and about your program. Thank you.
Thank you. This is great.
Kathy O'Connell is host of Kids Corner, heard nightly on WXPN in Philadelphia. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of All Things Considered. Robert, what's your latest story on the proposed pay raise for Congress?
Well, proposed may be out of date any moment now. It's more like the opposed pay raise. Tomorrow, the House of Representatives will vote on it. And that's exactly what the whole scheme that was put together was supposed to avoid. And when they vote, if as expected, they vote against a pay raise for themselves, then it won't happen because the Senate already voted for it.
What else are you covering?
Voted against the rather. We're also covering President Bush's plan to save the savings and loans and a special report by John Burnett on relations between new immigrants, Nicaraguans in Miami, and blacks.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. One of television's great detectives is back. His trademarks are a crummy old raincoat and a seemingly absent-minded but truly persistent investigative style.
One more thing, sir. Can you do me a favor? It'll only take a minute.
Lieutenant Columbo is back on television on a new network this week. Television critic David Bianculli welcomes his return.
Most of the time, any TV show that returns from the dead and comes back with fresh episodes long after its original cancellation is depressing to think about and disgusting to watch. A Very Brady Christmas is the very best example because it was the very worst program. And the new Mission Impossible isn't much of an improvement. And the news that a new Get Smart telemovie is right around the corner is hardly cause for celebration. Every once in a while, though, some TV show proves that you can go home again. The new CBS installments of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour have been fun. And starting this week on the ABC Monday Mystery Movie, returning after a 12-year absence, Columbo is back. And the best thing is, he hasn't changed a bit. Instead of adjusting to the passage of time, the producers of this new Columbo series have decided to ignore it. Peter Falk's hair has a little more gray, and his raincoat and car are a little more rumpled, but that's it. Columbo is still a lieutenant, he still rubs up against the most clever and polished murderers in the business, and still has the same unpolished way of interacting with them. In the pilot, his prime suspect is a psychic, played by Anthony Andrews of Brideshead Revisited.
Was that the card that you were thinking of?
That's it. That's incredible.
And I sense that that was the one that you were thinking of before you changed your mind.
You're
That's right, sir. That's the exact con. Look, I was thinking of a circle, and then I changed my mind. And you knew that. You knew the exact con. What I wouldn't give to be able to do that in my business. If I knew exactly what the suspect was thinking, well, I would make some wonderful detective.
Of course, Columbo is some wonderful detective. Falk is as charming as he ever was, maybe more so. And the script by William Woodfield is true to the high standards set by the old Columbo series. Andrews makes a very stylish villain, and the psychic settings allow for more mystery than usual. There never was much mystery in the old Columbo, except to see how Columbo would catch his quarry. That's what set it apart from all other mystery shows before or since. And since every show begins with the murderer committing his crime, you instantly know who done it. It's the cat and mouse game that counts.
Well, now I gotta admit, I'm confused, sir.
What confuses you, Lieutenant?
You're feeling the way you do about Mr. Dyson. I can't help wondering, why did you agree to be tested by him?
Well, that's simple. Dyson's client insisted upon it.
Do you mind telling me who that client was, sir?
I'm sorry, Lieutenant. I can't tell you his name. Like everything else around here, that's a secret.
Well, there I go, asking the wrong questions again, sir. Whenever I do that, you just stop me, sir, the way you just did.
The only part of this new Columbo episode that doesn't quite work is the climax, which puts Columbo unnecessarily and illogically at risk. Otherwise, it's a delight, and Columbo is one old TV show that is welcome back anytime. Oh, one more thing. Columbo is part of an anthology series, and the other shows in this so-called mystery wheel are programs starring Burt Reynolds and Lou Gossett. They'll be reviewed separately. Columbo, as always, stands out above the rest.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, cultural historian Lawrence Levine challenges the distinctions between highbrow and lowbrow. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles the bands that created what he calls the Northwest Sound, from their pre-psychedelic days through their drug songs of the 60s. And book critic John Leonard reviews A Turn in the South, Indian writer V.S. Naipaul's account of his travels through the American South. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Ed Doherty. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Deborah Beagle. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.